And writing has actually been really, really good therapy. It's either been the cheapest or most expensive therapy ever, because I then went on a massive guitar buying rampage, so it could be the most expensive therapy ever, but you know.
The economic time to be doing such a thing, and it's very, very high risk because of not just how good the quality is in a home, but also because of AI. And
one of my very, very first gigs, let me put it this way. One of my very, very first gigs coming out of uni was I played naked in a comedy show for 6 weeks. I would sooner do that again than sing on stage. Find a community. You know, really, really try and find a community of people that you trust and that you love. Like those, that's going to be more important to you.
Yeah,
than,
that's easy.
That's, yeah, yeah, that's, yeah, it's so easy. That's why we've all done it.
Welcome to Songwriter Trysts. This is an intimate podcast that is connecting songwriters from all over the world. I'm singer-songwriter Ray Lee. Music saved my life, and I love talking with other artists about the power of songwriting and their journey to where they are today. This is a safe space to share stories, lessons, and emotions, all the great things that build an amazing song. Please support the podcast by subscribing, or you can buy us a coffee, all through the website songwritertrysts.com.
Watson, I am predominantly a bass player, although multi-instrumentalist, which we can talk about later. I, for the past decade, have been a touring bass player. I've played with a bunch of people, especially in country music. So most recently just came off a almost 7-year run with Andrew Swift. I've played with Bill Chambers, Greta Zilla. I'm a member of Jen Mize and the Rough and Tumble, so 8-piece soul band out of Queensland. I do studio stuff. I play a lot of upright bass. That's kind of me now, and then transitioning into being an artist and songwriter and multi-instrumentalist and producer and all of that kind of stuff, which is a somewhat recent move.
It's a massive transition, and I want to talk about that, but I want to go back, not to like, you know, the crib or anything, but when did you start with music? When did you find out that this was going to be a passion of yours?
Music's always been around our house. So my mother, while she doesn't play an instrument, is a very, very musical woman. We had a lot of music in our house. Like she had a great CD and record collection, like, you know, everything from Roy Orbison to Smashing Pumpkins to Soundgarden to film scores. My mum's not that much older than me, so she was a very much like in her late 20s when the 90s started. So she's a grunge baby. So we had music all through our house. And I took piano lessons as a kid, but I didn't really want to be a musician until I was relatively late in the game, like probably like 16 or something, when I joined a band playing keyboards. And we were doing Van Halen and Kiss covers and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't exactly, you know, we weren't exactly playing hits at the time. But that was when I really got... I really, really wanted to do that. Like, I really, really wanted to be in a band. And then I had a really, really great piano teacher, a guy named Ryan Black, who would, like, sort of, because I was a bit of a rambunctious kid at school, who I would have piano lessons with, but at the end of each piano lesson, he would give me a CD to go home and listen to. And then I would bring it back the next week and talk about it. And by the time that I was done with a year of piano lessons with him, I'd listen to every single David Bowie record. I'd listen to every Queen record. I'd listen to like every Beatles record, bunch of film scores. So by the time that I sort of was proficient enough on an instrument, I already knew what good music sounded like. And I just knew that I wanted to do that. So that's kind of how we got here. Yeah.
What do you think it was about being in a band, and like what captured you? What sucked you in?
I think it's the collaborative, like the group aspect of it, like the sort of community aspect of it. I really, really like. So it's like being in a gang. You know what I mean? Like it's great, especially when it's like a sort of garage band and you're not all great and you're trying to figure out how to play your instruments and you're like, oh, have you heard this? Oh, you know, you end up in a little group of people that share music with one another. I mean, it's like that now. Like the chat thread on the Rough and Tumble chat thread is exactly the same as my high school chat thread, which I think says a lot to the maturity of the people who are in that band. But it's great. It's just, and you know, it's sharing music and sharing art, and that community mindset of it is always something I've really been drawn to.
I love that. I think not having a community stopped me actually for a long time doing music because I didn't want to do it by myself.
Yep.
And then I had to get over myself and just do it anyway. But I agree. I think there is something nice about it. It's kind of like team sports and individual sports. It's like it's always funner to do team sports because then you got instant friends, right?
Yeah, and it's funny. I do quite a lot of remote bass sessions from home. So people send me tracks and I'll send them out bass tracks. And I like doing it, but I kind of miss the immediacy of the feedback of having somebody in the room where you're like, is this good? You know, you get, and especially being a session musician where your whole audience is just the band that you're playing in, all those cues of like being able to see people's faces and see them light up if you're hitting it right or maybe not if you're not. And it's like, I miss, and that's all part of it. It's like, you know, like sort of bouncing and feeding off of one another. And, you know, if you ever see footage of me playing with anyone, I'm always trying to throw shapes and, you know, interact with the people that I'm playing with because it's, you know, you're in a gang. Even if it's just for one show, you're in a posse, you know.
I have seen you perform and you have great stage energy, which I've seen in a few bass players, but it really catches. I mean, it was the first night I met you at Tamworth in what's that place called?
The press club. Downstairs,
the
yes.
Press. Really cool venue, like cocktail lounge vibes, like something that you'd expect to see in the middle of Sydney or Melbourne, but in Tamworth. But you know, you had amazing energy that I just don't think a lot of people have. I'm always watching for this like stage energy that some people have and some people just don't. Was that always there for you, or was that something that you think you've just developed over time?
It's funny that because I have been accused of peacocking before, which is kind of funny, but it's like
that's exactly what you're meant to do.
Yes, exactly right. I think a lot of that comes from the bands that I liked as a kid and like now. So for somebody who plays country music, I'm actually quite a closet sort of rock and roll head. One of my favorite bands is like Nine Inch Nails. I love like 80s rock. Like I love like Van Halen and Kiss and like Motley Crue and all that kind of stuff. I've always been into bands that look like bands. I'm not a huge fan of the here's the artist and the band are 18 miles up the back in black t-shirts kind of vibe like that. And I mean, yeah. I've done plenty of those gigs, but certainly for me, it's like, my job is to make it look like, even if it's the first and only time I've ever played with a person, my job is to make it look like we have been doing this for 10 years and we're having fun and we're all that kind of stuff. And so it's just kind of like, I am a naturally energetic performer, and I think that is, I used to be really, I actually used to get really, really self-conscious about it because, you know, especially in country music, it's a lot of, again, like I said, it's a lot of guys and gals up the back in black t-shirts not wanting to shake the boat. But I got a really, really nice message one time from Matt Fell, record producer, who was like, who was basically just like, I love your energy. Please do not ever let anybody tell you to do less of what you are doing. And
yes.
So that was
go Matt Fell.
Yeah, go Matt Fell. He was being very, very sweet. I at one point sort of joked that I was a professional Matt Fell impersonator because of the amount of his bass lines I had to learn. But it's he's a very, very sweet guy, and I think and he had done a bunch of shows with us in Andrew Swift's band and was kind of, I think, liked that I was kind of getting him to rock out a little bit. So, you know,
I love it, and I agree with him. I think don't ever let anyone lose that. And I actually find it hard. It's harder to get people to do what you do versus saying, hey, can you just tone it down a bit, which I would just never do to anyone. It can be really hard to get people to like really show up and be on stage.
Yeah, I think it's definitely I think the aesthetic, again, like I say, I think the aesthetic comes from a lot of the music that I listen to and you know, and a lot of the performers that I like. Obviously it's circumstantial. Like I've done gigs with like Felicity Urquhart and stuff like that where you're not going to be headbanging to a great, you know, really in-depth folk song. But I look at people like Derek Frank, who plays bass with Shania Twain, or Eva Gardner, who plays bass with Pink and all that kind of stuff, and they're not wallflowering it up the back. Like, you know, they're part of the show.
And she'd want that. They'd all want that.
Yeah, and to be perfectly honest, I think that it's a security of performer thing. Like, I think that if your front person is secure enough to let their band have that moment, it holistically makes for a much better show.
Absolutely.
I think.
Yeah. I agree.
So,
but now you want to be the front person.
Well,
now you're releasing and doing
your own thing. At least in the studio sense. I don't know that my music's going to be getting played live anytime soon, but we'll see how we go.
Well, what's actually changed for you? You've got all this experience, you've worked with all these incredibly inspiring people who've done it for a very long time as well.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're flipping. What was the main catalyst to that change?
So I had been writing forever.
Tell me about your first song, actually.
Oh, I have it. I have it on my phone. I should send it to you.
Send it to me and I'll insert a little bit right here.
I was in a band. It's so funny. This is actually a really wild story. I was in a band like when I was a kid. With these older guys. It was a band called Splurge and they were a great Melbourne band. And we went away to do demos for a record, and the demos sounded great, but the record never got made. The band broke up and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, like 12 years later, one of the guys was trying to finish that record and finish the song that he and I were kind of co-writing, and was like, nobody has been able to play bass as well as you played it on the demo. Can you come back and do it 12 years later? Which was really funny.
Soon turned rotten, ill-conceived, and misbegotten in my all-time greatest hits, you'll see. You still come in at 1, 2, and 3. This life.
So my first song was like this big grungy kind of like shoegaze rocky kind of thing called This Life. But then like I've been writing instrumental stuff for ages, like for as long as I knew how to do it. And I've always been into audio technology and all that kind of stuff, and always been into recording. So it's always been sort of bubbling on the down low. I guess the recent pivot has been that at the end of last year, I kind of made the decision to step back from my main touring gig, to kind of reassess and regroup, I guess, and focus on my own health and all that kind of stuff. We'd had an especially big touring year with Andrew Swift, and I was getting burnt out, and then so it was like, well, what am I going to do? You know, am I going to try and find another sort of gig of that caliber? And I went on a writing weekend so I had sent Jen Mize, who's the sort of front woman for Jen Mize and the Rough and Tumble, just some instrumental demos of songs, like kind of like some soul funky things and some sort of Aerosmithy rock things that I'd done here. And she was like, can you come up for the weekend and help me co-write some stuff? And we did, and the songs came out great. But she was really, really encouraging of me to continue to do this. And so I just sort of was tinkering around with stuff at home and sort of doing like my ambient kind of instrumental stuff, which is what's coming out.
Yeah.
And just sort of decided one day, well, I've played everything, I've mixed it, I've mastered it. How much is it to chuck it on, you know, a distribution platform, put it out there? It's $29 and, you know, whatever I paid for artwork to Lisa DeAngelis, who I have to give a plug.
No, I know Lisa.
Yeah. Lisa's awesome.
She did your artwork.
Lisa did my artwork. Yes, she was great. For her graphic design company is called DeVille, I think. So I'm going to give them a plug. Sure. So I was out a bit on graphic design for the art and whatever it costs to do distribution. And I was like, all right, well, I may as well just start putting this out just because I can, really. And writing has actually been really, really good therapy. It's either been the cheapest or most expensive therapy ever, because I then went on a massive guitar buying rampage. So it could be the most expensive therapy ever. But, you know,
we don't say that's expensive. We say it's an investment.
Yeah, it's an investment. It's an investment, right? But it's kind of funny because it's like the longer, and, you know, you don't release the video for this, but I'm in my studio right now and I'm in here every day. Like, and always making stuff, and since basically January have just been like resurrecting old ideas and putting polishing ideas on the last one. And I truly have not felt more myself as an artist than what I have mm-hmm. been doing this. And I'm still doing like tons of bass stuff. Like I just finished doing a record for like a band in a folk band in Chicago, and then doing Jen Meiser's solo record, and then we're going to go back and do the Rough and Tumble thing later, and still playing bass live. But certainly now it's like this is kind of the thing that I'm doing for the next little bit.
Cool. Are you going to go to Chicago to play live, or are they just doing sessions?
No, it's just session stuff. I've kind of the wonders of the internet are really, really interesting. I've kind of got a little bit of a Chicago Chicago community over there that I just connected with through the pandemic. So there's a really, really great drummer producer named Sarah Netchweed who I'm friends with there, who's kind of helped me tap into that scene. So there's a whole group of them. We all chat on Instagram and send each other Christmas cards and all that. And, you know, if they need upright bass on things, I do that. Sarah's been on a bunch of my Instagram videos as well. So if anybody sees videos of a awesome chick drummer, it's likely Sarah.
Cool. I'll have to check it out. I love Chicago. I think you have to get there and visit.
I've been threatening to go there for a couple of years, and I think that Sarah and Lou Hennise, who's the singer for the band Gunslingers that I did the record for recently, I think that they would all like that. It's just time and money, like everything is in life.
Just go.
It'll be fine. I'm really glad
it's in the budget.
It's really not. I might have to sell a guitar.
Now you're making your own stuff. You said something before. I can't remember if it was before the podcast or not, about getting to a quality where you felt like it was releasable and you wanted to prove a point to yourself or someone else. But like, was there something that's happened in the industry, or as far as equipment that you got or learning, that you just something clicked where you were like, ah, this is now, you know, releasable quality music?
Really,
was it AI? Like, I don't know. Like,
No. It wasn't that at all. There's a couple of things and a couple of people that really did that. I think that's a really, really, really good question. So one of the things that did make me want to start putting this stuff out is hearing that other people were doing a very, very similar thing to me. Not here, but I'm listening to new music all the time. And I sort of stumbled upon this more sort of ambient kind of like instrumental version of country that I had only ever heard on one record, which I absolutely love, which is a Victor Krauss record called Far From Enough. Mm-hmm. But once you kind of hear other people kind of doing a thing like you're doing, at least in concept, you feel a little bit safer to put what you're doing out into the world. So that's number one. And then number two was just a whole heap of support and millions of questions answered from a couple of producer friends, namely Michael Carpenter, who I will acknowledge on this. Michael Carpenter, for anybody who works in the country music industry, is an amazing producer and a good mate of mine. But just his words of encouragement, just of like how to kind of, because I had said to him that I was wanting to do more production work and put stuff out. I wasn't necessarily talking about my own stuff, but just his words of encouragement and just some real practical tips on how to do it were quite good. And then honestly, it was getting feedback from people. So, you know, I sent the track to people that I trust, including yourself, you know, to get feedback on it and to hear the mix and to just go, is this something that I could run down the rabbit hole with? And everybody said two things. They were like,
I had no idea what I was going to be getting, you know?
Yeah, I know. You didn't really have anything aside from like, hey, I'm doing music. I don't sing, so it's all instrumental.
I mean, I knew that you were a good musician, but yeah. What do you mean you don't sing? Like,
I don't sing. Have never sung.
Like you've never even tried, not even in the shower, not even for fun.
No, I sing for fun, but I've never sang on stage ever.
Okay, but like, would you?
No, let me put it this way. One of my very, very first gigs. One of my very, very first gigs coming out of uni was I played naked in a comedy show for 6 weeks. I would sooner do that again than sing on stage.
I mean, I would do that too, but just for shits and giggles. hang on a second. So you just feel insecure about your voice, or just is it very vulnerable?
It's just not a thing that I've developed because I've always been because I've always been interested in instrumental music. It's just never been a thing that I've really developed. If I took the time to do it, it's also a time at this point now. It's a time consideration. Like I would love to be like somebody like James Gillard, who has the voice of an angel and plays bass like an absolute legend. But it's just time at this point. Like it's like, you know, I've got to spend enough time getting good at that thing. You can't see me pointing at my.
The people at home
can't see me pointing at the big bass at home like that. That's a whole lifetime's worth of work in and of itself. So it's kind of like, yeah.
That's fair enough. I agree. You got to pick what you actually want to spend your time on.
Yeah, I had to do an interesting thing with a gig last year where I had to mime singing. That was really interesting because I did a gig for an artist, a pretty popular artist in Australia, who had this is no secret, right? Like I'm not about to tell anybody that Santa Claus isn't real, but a lot of the backing vocals and things are on tracks, right?
Yeah.
Which is not a world that I hugely operate in. I don't tend to play a lot with artists who have these sort of big wall-to-wall tracks. Not that I got anything against it. I just not in my wheelhouse. But I was doing this gig and there were a ton of, and so the artist, you can edit this out later if you want, was Taylor Moss. Taylor Moss was like, okay. You can leave it in. She won't care. Do you sing? And I was like, no. And she's like, oh, that's okay. Well, all the BVs are on tracks anyway. So I was miming into
you just pretend.
I was just pretending. I'm probably the only person who mimes vocals out of tune.
That's funny. Well, I mean,
thank you.
Doesn't matter, does it?
No,
miming out of tune.
Which makes songwriting for people like Jen and I've got some tracks sort of in the works for like Colin Lilly and some other people in the computer at the moment. But it makes it really it does make that really really difficult on one hand because I can't be prescriptive about the things that I want from vocals and therefore the onflow of that is that I don't write a ton of lyrics. But what it also means is that it's like I can just let them do what they want, you know.
Yeah. You don't have like control over that.
No, and I'm not one of these people who it's like I don't necessarily feel the need to be super prescriptive about things. Like when I went to go and do this writing thing with Jen, a lot of what it was I'd bring the instrumental ideas and then Jen would top line it and then we'd kind of work around concepts for lyrics and she'd kind of do the bulk of it because she's a genius lyricist. You know, so just playing at everybody's kind of strengths, you know.
Yeah, oh, I absolutely love that. And I love working with people who are really good lyricists.
I think feedback as an adult is really, really interesting because it could do one of two things, and this has certainly been what it's been like for me. I think number one is what it does is that it obviously does what we all expect feedback to do, which is, you know, shows you areas that you can improve upon and get better at and all that kind of stuff. But I think the other thing that it does that is often gets overlooked is that it can actually reinforce the things that you're doing well. Yes. So, and the things that are worth pursuing. And again, I had this conversation with Jen the other week where she was like, we were obviously giving each other feedback back and forth about the songs. And what it did for me is really reinforce that it's like instrumentally, like to keep going down that road and keep writing the same way that we've been writing and all that kind of stuff. So I think the feedback is, yes, it tells you what you need to improve upon and, yeah, if I need to write more lyrics and yada, yada, yada and all that kind of stuff. But that whole thing of reinforcing the things that you're doing right and maybe guiding you down the path that you should be going down, I think is overlooked and needs to be acknowledged a little bit more.
Absolutely. I've had a conversation with a lot of people because we've got the retreat coming up next month and a lot of people wanting to come and kind of deciding, you know, who's going to come and how's going to work. And I was talking to one person about like what's the difference between like a professional musician and a beginner musician because, you know, it's such a huge thing. Like how do you really define a professional versus a beginner? And I kind of put it down to one person for what I look for is the basic simple steps between this group of beginner people and then this group of like who I would call a professional is someone who knows their strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say I would say that. Or at least is or at the very least is willing to do the work to understand those things. Yeah, I think that that one of the things that I always regret a little bit is as a professional musician trying to chase things that were not things for me. And so what I mean by that is it's kind of like, you know, as we receive feedback about the things that we're good at and things that we're not and all that kind of stuff, you know, I a lot of the time have sort of put that aside for my own bullheaded version of what I think I want to be as opposed to what I'm being told of my strengths and all that kind of stuff. So when it comes to, for instance, like, so there's gigs I don't get called for, right? So like all of those, like, you know, I don't get called for many things like house band gigs or things like that. Like, you know, like I'm not going to be in the Golden Guitars band anytime soon or anything like that. But, and I always viewed that as, well, it's just because I'm not a good enough musician. When what I was actually doing was ignoring the feedback of, no, what you are is like you're a really great performer and you're very energetic and you bring a vibe and all that kind of thing, which is not appropriate for that, but it is appropriate for this. And so that's one of the things that I really, really wish I had done differently when I was starting out, was paying more attention to that sort of feedback and that kind of gentle nudging that the universe and my peers were giving.
Yeah, okay. So people were trying to encourage and also give feedback, but you were ignoring it, or like
I think I just had a really, really bullheaded version of what I wanted to be. Like I just thought I wanted to be, you know, and we could go into a whole thing about how wildly wrong that was. But it was like I just wanted to be bass player up the back in a black t-shirt, and you know, found myself in many a situation where, you know, wasn't doing that and wanted to be more creative and wanted to be more expressive and all that kind of thing. So it was kind of like ignoring the thing that you're sort of the feedback in the universe is pushing you into. I'm on this whole trip at the moment about, like, you know, reassessment of artistic self. So it's kind of, I'm in that mindset at the moment.
With your songwriting and what you've done now to get to where you are now, what would you say are some of the biggest aha moments that you've had as a songwriter, and some of the goals that you have as a songwriter? Like, who do you want to work with? What do you want to do and achieve as a songwriter?
Oh yeah, cool. So I think again, going back to what I was saying earlier, I think that the aha moment for me was that there is actually a place for my music. Like God bless Spotify for sort of shoveling me down an algorithm where I was like, oh, so people are actually doing this. So that was a big aha moment for me. Goals is kind of like, I should have a look at my goals list because it is over there. I have a visible one. So this year
got pictures and everything?
It doesn't have pictures. It's got the scrawlings of a madman on it, but it is there. So goals this year, I mean, I guess for myself will be to, I would like to try and get at least somewhere between 4 and 6 pieces out by the end of the year. You know, all self-produced and self-mixed and all that kind of stuff. On that list is one of the goals was to get some songs on the Rough and Tumble record, which is going to happen, which is great. I'm really, really happy about that. And another one would be to, I would really, really like to do a write and produce with an artist that is not me, or not necessarily somebody that I know that well. There's a couple of people who I'm sort of bouncing files with back and forth at the moment. So Billie Joe Porter being one of them, who's a dear friend.
Yeah.
Who's a
she's
dear?
Great.
Yeah, she's great. BJP's awesome. I play in a live band, so that was kind of a bit of an easy in.
Cool.
And a couple of other people as well who I'm sort of floating ideas around to see what we can do. And that'll kind of get me through to the end of the year. I'm kind of taking this, I mean, it sounds crazy to go, I'm taking this a little bit conservatively to go, you know, oh, 4 solo releases, a bunch of stuff on a Rough and Tumble record and maybe produce somebody else's stuff. But it's, but for me, that's pretty conservative. And I'm having a very, very light by the look of it, it's going to be a very, very light touring year. So I'll be in here chipping away at that.
So just spending time in the studio writing. That's your 1 year goal, and your say 10 year goal. If you were to do a lot of that sort of co-writing, producing, getting
artists. I mean, ultimately the goal's real funny because I was thinking about this the other day. I need to think about the best way to answer this. I think whatever I do, and I mean, I guess 10 year goal is that it's like, you know, continue putting my own stuff out. I mean, the nature of my music is that it's very, very apt for things like sync and film and stuff like that. So hopefully some stuff there, and you know, and maybe we move into a realm where I'm producing for other artists. One of the things that I am absolutely determined to do if I start producing things for other artists, which I would like to do, is to do it as authentically to myself as possible. And so what I mean by that is that, like, I look at somebody like I look at a producer like Daniel Lanois, for instance, where it's like it doesn't matter whether he's working with Willie Nelson or U2 or Emmylou Harris or whatever it is, like that sonic signature, like people go to him for that sonic signature. It's not factory production. It is we're going to that person for that sound and that aesthetic and that kind of that ethos, I guess, of, you know, whatever Lanois does. So 10-year goal would be to be working with artists in an authentic and true to myself way.
Yeah, the people are coming to you for your sound that is unique to you.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly don't want to do I kind of think my days of doing anything my days of doing anything factory-like or for a paycheck are kind of over. I think, like, it's, you know, if I'm not investing, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard. Like, you know, certainly I was looking at like let's call a spade here, like touring with a sort of mid to up tier male country artist who does all the festivals is awesome for the paycheck. And, you know, it's I'm looking at a pretty lean financial year, like musically without that. But the cost to me now, the cost to doing things that I don't feel invested in is just too high. So like, so I'll play with there's still plenty of like actual like bass gigs where I feel like that. Like, I love playing in Billy Joe Porter's band. I'm really, really invested in that. I'm obviously invested in the Rough and Tumble, because I'm a member of that band. And, you know, but really 10-year goal will be to be building a life and a career of things where I'm being more authentically me and being able to impart my sound and what I know about music onto things rather than just you know, doing it for other reasons.
Doing it for the paycheck. Yeah. I love that, and I think it shows a real sense of maturity. I mean, I'm not trying to sound uncool or motherly, but like,
thanks, Mum.
when we're young, you know, we want the car and we want to keep up with the Joneses and we want the paycheck and we think, and even I see my kids, you know, they think that money is everything and that's going to solve all our problems. I'm not saying that life with money isn't easier and we should all work hard to make sure that we're valued and we get what we need, but there's a balance between your paycheck and your mental health and your quality of life. And like, you know, and that's a hard one to find. And I think it's something that, you know, it's a maturing of understanding of what life's all about, you know, and you got to enjoy it because tomorrow is not a given.
Yeah, I've done a fair whack of sort of teaching on and off in my time, and I had to. I remember 1 year, I had to go and give a talk to. So one of my friends is has been a music teacher he was my VCE music teacher of all things. But it's like I remember going and giving a talk to his VCE students, and I don't know why I was feeling particularly grizzled that day, but the advice I gave was sort of somewhat apt, where I was like, the best thing that you can do for your art is go and get a job. Because otherwise you'll have to say yes to a bunch of things that you don't want to do. And the more and more that you say yes to, and this is the funny thing, a successful musician, the more things that you say yes to, the more things you're going to get offered that are the same thing, right? So you sort of got to be really careful what you wish for, because if you start saying yes to a lot, and this is kind of the boat that I sort of found myself in, where it was like, I was super, super thankful to be being called for road gigs and being called for live gigs and all that kind of stuff. But because that was all I was doing, that was all I was doing, right? So so I didn't even have time to try and be an artist, let alone be seen as one, because every time you're seen playing with somebody else, you know? So it's like, so just don't ever, my days of saying yes to things for money are over, basically.
I love it.
I'll be poor. I might need to come and live at somebody's house.
What great advice.
Yeah.
All right, tell me then, what other great advice would you give to people who are starting out, maybe the VCE kids or...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was killer advice, but is there anything else that you nail on top of that?
No, I mean, my advice, it really depends on what you want to do. I think my advice would be to find a community. You know, really, really try and find a community of people that you trust and that you love. Like those, that's going to be more important to you.
Yeah, that's easy.
It's so easy. That's why we've all done it. But certainly, it's like, you know, if you're at all familiar with the concept of the gig triangle being, you know, money, music, and people, the people one is probably the most important. So it's like just prioritize people over everything else. I would say don't shy I heard a great phrase the other day, Ray, and I would probably do this one, but this is probably advice that I would give to somebody who's maybe like 5 years into their career or something like that, which is shake hands with the musician that you are. And what I think that piece of advice means is that it's like, learn to, you know, we so often view ourselves musically and artistically through our deficiencies, right? Like the gigs we're not getting or the things we can't do or the things of this and yada, yada, yada. Eventually you have to shake hands with the musician that you are and come to an agreement and go, well, you know, this is the musician that you are and this is the artist that you are and you are the best at being the thing that you are. That is a piece of advice that I have really only just taken myself, but that would probably be like if find a community of people and do stuff with your friends and your close friends is sort of VCE, just starting the career, shake hands with the player that you are is the 5 to 10 year mark. That's the advice that I would give me now.
I love it. It sounds like you're really getting into it.
Yeah.
And it's I think you hit the nail on the head with the right people. Like if you're with the right people, you're gonna have fun. And that goes for any job, not just music. I think if you're working in some corporate job or you're building a house or whatever, if you're working with your friends and people you get on with, well, you're gonna have a good life. If you're working with a horrible boss and mean people and there's a really bad culture, like it's bad for everything in your life. Like it will seep into everything, and I reckon it goes for all industries in life. It's not just music, but I mean music, you're going to be spending maybe a little bit more time with the people that you're working with, so it's even more important.
yep you certainly are. Like again, it's the I would rather hire somebody who I can sit in a van with for 4 hours driving to, you know, somewhere in regional Queensland to play a festival, like a bull riding festival, than a virtuoso musician who's a pain in the derriere.
Yeah. No, it's I think it's something you don't do very often. If you have to do it, you'll only do it a few times before you realize you don't want to be doing that ever again. Let's talk about your music.
Yeah.
So
cool.
You've got a single coming out.
I do.
Tell me about this one and why you chose this one to be the one that's gonna be your first
debut out. Yeah, cool. So the song is called Introverse. It's coming out on the 26th of April. The title is very much so. The song is it's all instrumental, obviously. The ethos of the song is kind of like I explained it to myself in writing some stuff about it. It was very much the soundtrack into, like, if you were sort of going inside into that little universe inside you where your sort of creativity and all that kind of stuff lives, it's the soundtrack to that sort of journey inward, I guess. So that's what the title means. In terms of why this one, I think because of all the things that I was kind of working on at the time, so I sort of went on a big sort of I went on a really, really big writing spree at the start of this year because I just needed to get some thoughts out and do some healing. Nice. And some of those things ended up as songs that are going to be on the Rough and Tumble record. And then there was this whole other stuff that, yeah, it was this instrumental cinematic sort of ambient kind of thing. I think I picked this one because it's, like, truthfully, I think I picked this one because it's the least sort of, it's the least departure from things that I have been associated with in my life, I think. Like, it's still pretty, it's pretty interesting. Like, certainly when the CMAA do their Look Back Friday, it's going to be the weirdest thing on there. But for instance, it's not the one with the minute and a half ambient tape loop with the spoken word intro on it. It's the most kind of, I think it's the most accessible. So I think in terms of a, like a nice sort of appetizer as to what I sort of think artistically, it's a good intro for that. So that was why I chose this one to start with.
Have you got some with the spoken word in it? Or
I do. I'm literally working on it. I was literally working on it. Literally working on it today. It's a minute and a half loop. It's literally a minute and a half tape loop with I found a I found like a spoken word poem on Splice, which is the loop thing that I use. Really sort of captured the ethos of what the song to me is about, because they do, whenever I write instrumental stuff, I write it with a story in mind. Like I kind of, it's very much film scores without a film, if that makes sense, but there's moments, like I write for, I write for moments and I have ideas. And so for what I was kind of, feeling about this one, I was listening to, it's kind of funny, I was like, I went to go and write like a really, really nice instrumental country song and then was listening to a bunch of Lana Del Rey. So it's kind of very like, I was watching the 10-minute, because I just listen to everything. You know the 10-minute version of the Ride video where she does that whole thing about like she's no one's and she's everyone's and all that kind of thing? Like it's got like this massive, massive intro.
I've seen that.
I'll send you the link. It's great.
Check it out.
But I was watching.
It's like a short film.
It's like a short film. And so I was watching that the other night, and then like I just was randomly like, oh well, I wonder what happens if I chuck a spoken word intro underneath this thing before it even starts. And I did. Yeah. So what I think will be the next, what I think will probably be the next song that I'll put out in a couple of months is a. Will be an instrumental country song where it's a minute and a half of tape loops and a spoken word intro before you even hear a Telecaster. Yes. So, you know, just going back to, and this we can put in. But
okay.
the funny thing about that song with the spoken word intro to it is that there is actually, even though before I said I don't write lyrics, I have written like a spoken word piece for the start of that song that I think I might maybe get somebody to do, but I need somebody who's got the right voice. Like it needs to be like that American kind of Sam Elliott lonely cowboy thing. Otherwise I'm just going to stick with the cool thing that I found. That's like the sort of, you know, French lady, the Lana Del Rey-esque thing. It'll be one or the other, but I'd like to.
Why wouldn't you use your own voice?
My voice? The subject matter is a little bit touchy and I don't know that I would necessarily want my fingerprints on it.
It's your song though, right?
It is my song. it is my song, but the spoken word thing kind of it is talking about a very, very specific moment, and I don't know that I'm ready to be the person that talks about that specific moment just yet. I think it would need to be like a Sam Elliott voice actor kind of thing, because it's something that's a little bit close to the soul. That's why I haven't really like gone the whole hog of getting it recorded yet. We'll see.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm a big believer in the more universal. The more personal, the more universal. I do like that phrase. I think Lynn Botel preaches that one.
Yeah, she does.
I think, like, the scariest and songs that I've put out have been the most vulnerable. And if it is really, really vulnerable, then, you know, I'd challenge you to at least try it.
Well,
since you're in your studio by yourself anyway.
Sure. I think the thing is that it's like one of the things that I like about instrumental music too is that it is so the meaning of it outside of the title is very, very much left to the ears of the beholder. Like you can take out of that whatever that you want. This so the thing that I wrote to go over the intro of this song is very literal. So it takes that ambiguity out of it, and okay. I don't know that if I do it, I'm the person to do it. Because then
could you put it into a short film? Like, could you make it a short film?
Well, I do that for a lot of the music anyway. So I'll go out and film stuff. Because initially, like if we want to talk a lot about why I started writing in the first place, a lot of it was because I just listened to tons of film scores and I wanted to be a film composer. So, yeah. You know, because I'm super, super inspired by Tyler Bates, who's a very, very guitar orientated sort of film composer, super, super inspired by Hans Zimmer and like all those kinds of things, and then Trent Reznor's film scores and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to be a film composer. So when I can, and I'm relatively savvy on guerrilla warfare video, so I'm okay to go and take an iPhone out and shoot, you know, whatever to kind of tell a story. So the song that's coming out, if I get around to making it, may have sort of an accompanying video, which will be a lot of sort of stock footage and not stock footage, sorry, but like scenery shots and things that I sort of, to me, tell the story. I was out at Dalesford recently and just shot a bunch of stuff out there.
Nice.
But
get some wine.
Well, I got too many beers is the problem. I'd love to put it to a short film. So we'll see. Maybe I'll do it.
That's one of my dreams. I did my first writing for film last year, and then it was in Flickr Fest, the Byron Bay Film Festival.
Yep.
So fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a big lover of film and music.
Yeah, me too. It's and it entirely music in film entirely can change the and this is kind of like what I quite like about it is that the underscoring of a scene will completely change the context of that scene without having to use any words, you know. And the most hilarious and relevant example of this is and it's so stupid, but it so highlights this point perfectly. Which is, there's a video of Bruce Lee about to fight Chuck Norris where they've taken out the underscoring, which is very like this big kind of like thumping kind of kung fu thing, and put Careless Whisper underneath it. and it changed and it's like them taking their karate gear off about to beat crap out of one another, which when you've got the underscoring makes it sound like they're about to beat the crap out of one another. But when you put like Careless Whisper underneath it or whatever the song is, like it's like this real like big, what's the George Michael song with the big sax intro in it? I always forget.
Yeah, it's like they're about to make love.
Yeah, it's like they're about to get down, a very different kind of down. And so it's the most ridiculous yet most apt example of that ever.
That's hilarious. Yeah, and yeah, I've seen lots of examples of that and they teach it in parenting programs as well about how important the feeling under what you're actually seeing and what triggers are and all that sort of stuff. Mm. So, and I completely agree. The music makes everything, and it can be cheesy or it can be authentic or it can be loving or it can be scary and it's hilarious, but it goes completely unnoticed as well.
Yeah, I think the great stuff does. Like it's
It should go unnoticed.
Yeah. And then sometimes
people shouldn't realize it's happening.
Hans Zimmer, where it's like more is more.
But
you know, I love that as well. But there's a lot of like especially some of those like those Trent Reznor film scores where it's like this very, very understated kind of like suspended piano things and all that kind of stuff. I'm big into that. So, yeah.
So if you could collaborate with anyone in the world, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
It would probably be. This is a hard one because then it's because there's like there's people. Okay, I have to answer this in two parts because there's people whose band I would want to play in, and then there's people who I would want to collaborate in. If it's play in their band,
okay. Whose band do you want to play in?
Specifically, I would like to play in David Bowie's 2004 reality tour band, but then I'd have to kick Gaylan Dorsey off bass, and I wouldn't want to do that. But in that scenario, definitely that. In terms of collaborating,
are there many scenarios where they have two basses?
Well, unless you're Spinal Tap, not really. You know?
Yeah, not really, is it?
I know a lot of bands that would love to not have one bass player, but that's okay. Oh, Sting, actually, do you know what? There's a cool video of Sting playing in a courtyard in Italy where it's him and Christian McBride playing bass. So, you know, there's that. In terms of people I would like to collaborate with, this is like real pie in the sky kind of thing, but I would love to produce a Lucinda Williams album.
Okay. Why that?
Because so Lucinda Williams has a real special place in my heart, and that when I first started playing country music, she was kind of the country music that I listened to because it's fairly accessible. Like she's kind of a bit rock and roll. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it wasn't that far removed from like Tom Petty and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So being able to do an album with her that is maybe a little bit more grungy, rock and roll-y kind of, you know, almost like I've got this thing in my mind where it was like if I could somehow get Lucinda Williams in the same room as like Queens of the Stone Age, and make this kind of like real janky, deserty, rock and rolly sort of like Americana country album. That would be on the top of my list. So probably Lucinda Williams or someone like really, really outlandish, like you know, Billie Eilish or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. It's a bit more like poppy.
Yeah, well, I think that song that she did for the Barbie soundtrack is one of the best songs ever written. So, you know, and I think and funnily enough, we're about to go on a whole thing here. But you talk about things that sort of validate to the point of feeling like you can do something. And you mentioned gear before. Since that song came out, I mean, I've been a Billie Eilish fan for a while, but since that song came out. You watch a whole heap of documentaries on how that song was made, and they made it in a bedroom using stock Logic plugins. So it's like, gear is not he mentions one plugin called Sketch Cassette, which I do use, everything else is like stock Logic stuff, and it's stock Logic stuff and good ideas. So it's like, well, the gear can't be an impediment. You know what I mean? And my studio is.
Yeah.
My studio is so simple. It's like it's a MIDI controller, couple of microphones, and I don't even own that many guitars for a dude that supposedly plays guitar for a living. There's like four on the rack. So it's like, it just doesn't, and I'm a gear nut. I love gear, but it just doesn't matter. Like, you know.
I do think I've heard a lot of excuses from people because they don't have the plugins. You know, it's like I haven't got all the fancy equipment, so I can't do it. And it depends on what you're actually trying to achieve. But I agree. I think you can do things with not much. I think when you haven't got the resources, you just have to, everyone has a brain. You've just got to think smarter.
I think
sometimes throwing money at stuff isn't always the answer.
No. And I mean like, and I deliberately, so, like I said, I don't have that many guitars. Like for a dude that plays bass for a living, I have two electric basses that are very, very different to one another and an acoustic upright bass. But electric guitars and my music is very like when this is the funny thing. Whenever I tell anybody that I'm writing solo music, they assume it's like bass music. Like, you know what I mean? Like kind of like solo bass stuff, and it's like no, it's not. In fact, the bass is probably the last thing that I record and it's the thing I pay the least attention to. It's primarily guitar driven. I have one guitar. It's a Telecaster. I have one electric guitar and it's a Telecaster. I recently...
So you probably don't need anything else.
No, well, but the other thing is too is it's just like you just figure out how to get the most out of the thing that you have, right? But then it's like... Yeah. When I did go and buy a second electric guitar, I bought the most reasonable electric guitar that a man can buy, which is a Resonator tenor four-string guitar that's tuned in fifths, super versatile.
Mm, yep.
But just because it's so just because it's so different to everything else, like it's just kind of like, you know, you can make do with not much, you know.
Yeah. And you know, you don't need all the fancy microphones and things like that, although once you get to a certain level, I've heard people say, you know, it's those little things that count. And I've always felt a bit intimidated when I go into a studio and they've got like a $5,000 microphone in front of me instead of my standard, you know, $300 one or whatever it is. So,
yeah.
And I can't tell the difference, but.
Well, it's a funny thing, right? So a guy, the guitar player from Andrew Swiss Band,
mm-hmm.
has predominantly been a home studio producer, like very, very nice home studio, but home studio nonetheless, and he's done heaps.
Yeah.
They've just opened up a massive commercial facility in Melbourne, like state-of-the-art $500,000 commercial. I mean, I don't know how much it costs, I'm assuming.
Like a studio?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, wow, okay.
Huge, giant live room, like big old-fashioned studio.
Yeah,
I prefer his home studio, to be perfectly honest. Like, I think it's I think there's too much good music being made on equipment and it's sad because I like recording studios, but there's too much good music being made on inexpensive gear. Like this mic that I'm talking into now is a $400 Sennheiser mic that is my acoustic guitar mic. If I have a vocal session in here, it's that, and I do it on my double bass. So there's that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I do. It'd be interesting, I guess, to watch someone who's just opened up a new studio, and there's been some studios locally that have popped up, and I agree. I think that it's probably not the economic time to be doing such a thing, and it's very, very high risk because of not just how good the quality is in a home, but also because of AI and what we can do now with very little soundproofing and like all this, you know, all this fantastic stuff that is it really going to add enough difference to validate that sort of expense?
Yeah,
interesting to see.
Yeah, that's
not something I'm going to be putting my chips in at the moment. But.
Yeah, I mean their financial situation is kind of all right, so they're less sort of slightly concerned
obviously
about that. But yeah, I know. But the one like I think that the quality of stuff now that even that you get in Logic, and I have only recently just started using more expensive stuff because I can. But I think you're arguing about differences that are very, very minimal.
Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you think we should talk about or you'd like to share before we finish up?
Keep your eyes peeled for – there's a couple of things. Yeah, so aside from my own music, there's a couple of things coming out that I will be that will have my bass work on them. So Jen Miser's solo EP will be out at some point this year, which is me predominantly on acoustic bass. Then we're obviously doing a Rough and Tumble record. There's a bunch of, I'm doing like a bunch of touring dates with, Billy Joe Porter and Link Phelps and Jen Miser. Gimpy's going to be a big one this year. That's probably it, I think. Yeah, that's it.
All right, and how can people follow and support you? Have you got any of your, like, a website?
Yeah, I do.
Socials?
Yeah. So all the same thing. So website is zachwatsonmusic.com. Socials is at zachwatsonmusic. I don't have a Spotify profile yet because I'm a baby artist and they don't give you one until you've actually put your music out. So,
oh, really? So they're not going to give you like a pre-save link or?
So there's a, so the way that it works, so this is again one of these things that I've had to work out because I don't know, like it's, you know, I've been playing with other artists for 10 years but I've never had to, 10, 20 years but I've never had to do this myself, is that it's like the way they work it is that your Spotify, you can do pre-save, so you can pre-save my song through Instagram. I'm on Instagram all the time. But they don't give you an artist profile that you can like edit and stuff like that until the song's live.
Oh, that's annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've got to wait for the song to be live on the 26th and then go claim the artist profile and then I'll put the Canvas thing up and all that kind of thing. Okay. So yeah.
See, I didn't do pre-save on my first single either because I didn't know what I was doing. I was just like, oh yeah, just put it up and then dumped it up and 2 days later it was live and then no one knew about it. I mean, yeah, you just learned.
Yeah, it's all that kind of stuff.
Thank you so much. I'm going to put a description of your music and all of your socials and everything into a blog and put it on songwritertrist.com and people can go and follow you and pre-save your new single and I wish you all the best in your artistic career as an artist and as well as a session muso. And are you welcome for people to reach out and if they want to work with you or
absolutely
best way?
I'd love to say website, but really Instagram.
All right. Well, that's fine. We'll put your Instagram link on there.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for joining our songwriter Trist today. To join the family and keep up to date with future podcasts, you can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. Please leave a review and subscribe. To support the podcast or contact me or our guests, please go to the website songwritertrists.com. Lost in the crowd.